Tonight, I wanted to speak about. I want to speak a little bit about religion itself. I don't know. I saw some students; they might be here for that reason. So I kind of anticipated that a little. But I also wanted to speak about a little bit about not so much getting in depth about epistemology. Which is how do you know that something's right, but just kind of analyzing, like, why in different religions there are different scriptures and different teachings, but usually there's a book, you have the Bible, you have different things. So generally in our culture, in our American culture, we understand that if you want to be good at medical science, that you better go to school for some time. And it's going to require a little sacrifice. It's going to require some dedication. It's going to require some serious training. If you just walk in a hospital and they said, okay, we need a heart surgeon, stat. And then you say, okay, I'm ready. What's your qualification? I read some books at the library. They're going to say, go away. So similarly, we have to understand that spiritual life, we generally don't think of it as something that requires an education. In our modern culture, we kind of put it into the category of faith or even hobby. On our Facebook profile, we might have, like, what's your religion? It's like, oh, it's a faith. So, in other words, we put spirituality as in the category, in religion, in the category of faith, and then career development, economic kind of financial development of the self, we put in the forefront. So generally, there's probably so many reasons for that. I won't get into that. But what I'm kind of referring to is just generally we have this tendency to stereotype religion as that's a faith. You have your faith. I have my faith. We all have our faith. But medical science, this is a real thing. You have to go to school. You have to understand. So I would like to present the idea that all the other scriptures are there, of course, but Bhagavad Gita, which is the teaching of Sri Krishna, it's a little bit different in the sense it doesn't talk about faith. It's not, this book is not a faith. It's more science, at least from a point of view of what it's directing us to or what it actually contains within it. It's not so much saying that, oh, you should believe this today. You should become a Hindu. You should become a Christian. You should. It's not saying to adopt a new identity. But Bhagavad Gita, it's really a scientific way for us to understand the most minute details about life. So Bhagavad Gita is a teaching of Krishna, and generally, this is another stereotype sometimes. We think, oh, if it's not American, then it can't be as advanced technologically or socially, because America is just the best. We have the best knowledge, we have the best education, we have the best everything. So we say, well, here's a book of Sanskrit. They say, oh, it's okay, but we've advanced way beyond that. We think like this. But actually, Bhagavad, just to give a quick example, the Srimad Bhagavatam is a Sanskrit composition. It's mind-blowing from a linguistic point of view, from an academic point of view. Somebody said, well, how do you know that the Bhagavatam has any truth in it? How do you know? Because it's an old religious text. So I said, okay, well, for you to consider with so much doubt, first you should consider this, that it's 18,000 verses composed in Sanskrit. Most of us are rusty in our Sanskrit, but there are some people who understand Sanskrit nowadays, and they'll tell you that what's in this amazing. Not only is there 18,000 composed verses of, like, poetic kind of meter, but in order to understand those meters, those poetic meters, people at minimum go to school for 12 years to understand the rules to even begin learning Sanskrit, what to speak of composing Sanskrit, and what to speak of having it mean sense. You have a sentence, and you have to fit it like a code, and certain words will only go in a certain place because they divide it by the syllables. It's a very complex language. So first, I would say, for me as a rational person, to consider that it's completely bogus, I would like to see the person who challenged to write 18,000 verses in Sanskrit with the rules. Then we can have discussion, because really it's that much of an education. This Sanskrit knowledge, it's deep, it's ancient, it has a lot of facts, truth. So Bhagavad Gita is such a book, but at the same time, although I speak highly of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, that's not to discount other religious testimonies or scriptures of the world. Just because something contains truth doesn't mean that the truth is only found in those pages. And this is what I really wanted to talk about. I think it's one of the most important things. Before we even think about religion, we should understand a couple things about the books, which I was saying I want to focus on. So what is the book? The book, it's really, if you think about it, it's a roadmap. It's a map. It's a guide. And that's why it behooves an intelligent person, when somebody comes up to you in the street and they say, "What do you believe in?" And you're like, "Well, if I had to pick something, I would pick this because my parents," or something that's usually... Then they say, "Well, if it's not in this book, it's wrong. Mine has the truth." So really, if you think of it like it is, it's a roadmap. It just because somebody's holding a map doesn't mean they achieve the destination. Just because you hold a map to Hawaii, Europe, I don't know where you want to go, France, you want to see Paris, just because you hold the map doesn't mean that you're there, is it? What do you have to do with the map? You have to use that map. And when you do, it's going to give you guidance. There's different directions, yeah, of course, you know, but ultimately you have to arrive at that destination, which is being talked about in the book. So the books, regardless, I'm not going to get into like the intricate truths of the Bible, of the Quran, of the Bhagavad Gita, but we have to understand that there are some universal truths. So we can't just say that truth has the label of Hinduism on it. We can't say that truth is a Christian truth, no more than we can put Christian or Hindu on water. So once I was living in a temple before I used to live here. Then I lived in Utah. They had a nice, beautiful ashram in the mountains, surrounded by mountains. They have a lot of animals. It's a very different atmosphere. It's not like San Diego, but I love San Diego. But definitely Utah is looks like a spiritual place. There's beautiful mountains everywhere. And I used to live in that beautiful temple there. It's like an Indian palace. And I used to give tours. That was one of my services. It was a nice thing. And I met one Indian couple, this elderly couple from India. They're married, very sweet people. But they had an interesting relationship going on. whereas the wife really was religious, spiritual. She believed in Krishna. She wanted to know about Krishna. And the husband was like, "Oh, this religion is nonsense. And I don't believe in any religion. It's just your religion, my religion." But they were happily, you know, married. But they, you know, they accepted each other's stance, you know. So actually, they got kind of into it, because they kind of got brought up. We were sitting in the temple, and she was talking about it and wanting to learn more. And then, you know, they kind of had a tiny argument. And then I said, "Well, if you think it's biased, then let me show you something." So in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 16th chapter, if Krishna said, there's two kinds of people in this universe, and there's two kinds of people only. And he said, those who are pretty much looking to help themselves and others through their actions, and those who are looking to help themselves at the cost of everyone. So he said, he categorizes them as like good and bad, pretty much you could say like that. So he said, what are the characteristics of a good person? Forgiveness, tolerance, patience, fortitude, determination, you know, freedom from, you know, covetousness, all these things. So I said, is forgiveness a Hindu quality? is forgiveness a Christian quality? But it is a quality that you have to have if you want to be Christian, and you have to have if you want to be Hindu. You can't claim to be religious of any kind if you don't have that quality. So this is what I'm talking about, is we have to understand that religion is not something that we just put a label on. or we just put clothes on. And yeah, maybe in the beginning we come to that, but we have to go deeper. We have to always be looking deeper. What is the essence of what this is trying to tell us? So why do people take a spiritual journey? That's kind of maybe a good thing to really analyze. People take a spiritual journey for different reasons, but again, just like we take education, we're trying to benefit ourselves. We're trying to get an advantage. We're trying to get an advantage in life. We want to know. We want to know how things work and operate. That's why we go to school. So when we go to religion, it shouldn't be for a different purpose. That's what I'm trying to present here, is religion. It's an understanding that has to be acquired from an expert on the subject. Bhagavad Gita is a very unique religious literature in that it gives us precise instruction how to act in spiritual consciousness. It's not vague. It's very clear. What it does is Bhagavad Gita analyzes action. The whole third chapter, fifth chapter, fourth chapter, it's all the way up to the end, to the 18th chapter of this 5,000-year-old Sanskrit text. It's all about work, karma, action. So well, the first time I read it, it just totally went over my head. I didn't know what it was saying. And that's a good point. I had to take an education. So I joined this temple. I learned from the guru, the commentaries. And we have history of all the previous gurus. Guru just means professor. It's just a professor of this knowledge. And through that education, you can see, oh, this is completely rational. This isn't a faith. It's just understanding how things work. So a major portion of Bhagavad Gita, to give you a little sample of this philosophy, how practical it is and how essential it is for no matter what spiritual path you're practicing, you can benefit your life. So first thing is Bhagavad Gita really brings our awareness to action. So and it talks a lot about two things all throughout Bhagavad Gita, karma and yajna. So karma, we know it's like, oh, I got bad karma today or something. So that's true. That's a kind of a karma. It's reaction. But really, karma means work. It means action. And yajna means sacrifice. So let's think about this. When I first read it, it was like work, 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 action, sacrifice. It went over my head. But after studying a little bit, I started to understand, oh, this is actually so universal that it just behooves an intelligent person to miss this wonderful thing, is that it's so universal because it's talking about the most fundamental thing in all existence, relevant to all living beings. What is that? Action. We're all born here with this body, so we're bound to move, to act. And what happens if you don't? Well, life keeps going. It's not waiting for you. So just because we have a body, it means we have to undertake all kinds of actions. We have to get a job. We have to go to school. We have to do, and whether we like them or not, there's a lot of pressure because we're bound to this body and everything's working by action. So Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you cannot even maintain your body without performing sacrifice or action. So all action is a kind of a sacrifice. This is what we really have to understand if we want to understand spiritual knowledge. All action is a sacrifice. So everyone came here and you sacrifice, they say, the human being's most valuable asset is time. So you have to sacrifice time. So whatever reason you're here, you had to sacrifice that because of some other investment that you made. So we're always making sacrifice. A husband sacrifices for his wife. A wife sacrifices for her husband, for her children. Everyone is sacrificing different things for different things. So Krishna says, this is the first thing you have to understand about sacrifice, is that action, everyone has to do it. Everyone's being forced to do it. And if you don't want to do anything, you want to just sleep in the street, and you're like, I'm not working 9 to 5. I still see them collecting cans. They still have to work. Everyone is forced to work. And for the soul, we don't want that. We just want to play all day. And that's what we want. We want happiness. We want pleasure. And the work is really just like, okay, I have to do this work in order to get what I want. And that's why I do it. So Krishna is giving us a very beautiful spiritual technology that transcends far greater science than any material technology that you'll find on this planet, because it goes deep to the root of our dissatisfaction. So the first thing he says, okay, you're bound to work now. Working is being kind of forced upon you just for being alive. So why not, he tells Arjuna, be a yogi. Become a yogi. And he's like, what is a yogi? He said, Siddhya Siddha Samutva Samatvam Yoga Muchate. Krishna gives a definition of yoga. Yoga means to work, to act, to make sacrifice, and you don't care for the success or failure. And then he says, you don't care for the fruits of your action. Fruits means the result. So what's a fruit? Okay, I go to work, I get a paycheck. If I do this, I get this. If I do this, I get this. So the fruits, you're chasing the fruits. So he says, be a yogi. And he said, what's the definition? It's a really important verse. He says, you have a right to work for the... You have a right to perform action. You have the right to perform action, but you don't have a right to enjoy the fruits. And he's like, never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities, and never be attached to not doing your duty. So pretty much he gives us two kinds of states of consciousness that any living being can take, but generally human beings can understand these things and act according to these instructions. So pretty much we're forced to act. There's two alternatives. He said there's two kinds of act. One is that you do the work for the sake of the work, not caring for the success or failure of the work. And the other is that you work not caring what kind of work it is, as long as you can achieve the fruit of your desire. So this is very profound, and that was kind of, you know, I'll try to explain that. It pretty much means that the person is in a state of consciousness that no matter if this is successful or not, I'm doing the right thing. And whether I'm going to get anything from it, it doesn't matter, because I'm not doing it for that reason. I'm doing it because it should be done. It should be done. And the other person's thinking, well, I'll do any kind of work. And the proof is that most of us, we get a job, or I've had many jobs, you just hate the work, but you really want the paycheck, so you're forced to do it. So in that way, you don't love the work, you love the fruits. So the work is actually can be quite miserable, but you keep chasing the fruits, so you keep doing it. So Krishna said, such a person lives in vain. And a person who lives in vain cannot be happy. Vain means selfish. It means they live for their own selfish ends. And he said, the yogi is beyond that. He gets pleasure out of doing the work. He gets pleasure out of doing the work in itself. But he also has a heightened knowledge which allows him to work like that, which is very important. That heightened knowledge is he knows something very important. Krishna says, Prakrite Kriya Manani Guna Karmani Sarvasha Ahankara Vimutatma Kartasvit Yabhimanyate. He said that person who can be a yogi, he knows that although I'm working, doing things with this body, I'm not the cause of the result. In other words, if you think that you own this body and whatever you do with this body belongs to you, whatever reactions that you cause, it belongs to you, he's saying you're an illusion. And I'll explain why. He says, because such a person, ahankar, under the false identification with himself, he thinks that we have possession of that which we do not. So, perfect example, this body, it's going on, we say it's my body. We say, this is my body. Like, you know, somebody comes to me and they're like, try to take my chatter. I was like, get away, this is my chatter, this is my body, right? So this is mine, it belongs to me, but at the same time, there's many things that I don't even understand about it. Like how I eat, I'm not thinking like, okay, it's time to digest food right now and da da da. We don't think like that. That I just like, okay, hair grow, you know, like I want, you know, it just grows on its own time. It's not something that we have control over. And furthermore, our conception, when you're in that illusion, that conception of life is that you are the center. There's billions of souls, people, individuals, and they're all here together, but we put ourselves in the center. So this is an important point, and I'll tie that into what I was saying about work, is that when we put ourselves in the center, we start chasing after some goal, which is pretty much something material. Power, beauty, fame, knowledge, so I can be more powerful. Why? Because I'm working to achieve something, a fruit for myself. And that passion is what drives us mad and what puts us into perplexity, because we can't understand that I'm being forced to work and nothing doesn't always go our way, but still in complete insanity, we keep making plans, even though that we know that this life's temporary, but we plan as if we're going to be here forever. So Krishna said, don't do that. Just work, perform work, because it's good work, and don't get attached. We're here temporarily. Krishna's saying, you're here temporarily. You don't own a building. You don't own land. Christopher Columbus came. He said he discovered, they say he discovered American school. It's like, well, how did he discover it when there's people here? So how did he discover it? So Bhagavad Gita is not this religion that's like, okay, be a Hindu, be a Christian. It goes way beyond that. And in fact, when we talk about Hinduism, you're talking about six very different schools of thought. Completely different. It's like calling, a vegan Nazi, somebody who's like, vegan or die, you know? And somebody who's like completely opposite, a Chargers fan who just likes to eat meat, right? And it's saying, okay, well, they're both Americans. Okay, but there's a gulf of difference in their values and what they believe, right? So we say Hinduism, we're talking about six different philosophies. So it's important that we also see a bigger picture, that we look at the world and as a scientific objective view, that, all right, every philosophy, every word that everyone speaks is a philosophy. So we have to try to understand that. But that's why I'm saying Bhagavad Gita is not like that. It's not just a philosophy. It's actually very specific guidance on how to act, how to work. So pretty much, this is the main difference between materialism, which is, you could say, selfishness-ism, and spiritualism, which is selflessness-ism. So materialism means that you think that material gain is the main thing in life. Krishna says, kripana. He said, the person's a miser. They work to possess things. And in that working, why is that bad? Why is that bad? It's a free country. It's a free will. But they get a reaction completely opposite of what we really want, which is to be happy. And instead, we get bound in a network of all kinds of unnecessary desires. So, okay, so to sum it up, the whole purpose of spiritual education is, again, it's like any material education, is to give us an advantage in life. It's to give us an advantage. It's to increase our happiness. It's not, religion is not here to give us a bunch of rules and, okay, now I have to sacrifice. Okay, I talked about why people come to religion, right? But why don't people not go to religion? This is very interesting. We should understand that. Why? It means I have to give up so many things. I have to, you know, maybe I have to wear only one color or something. But that's the thing, although some of us are doing that, you'll see in Bhagavad Gita, you won't see this in Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is Krishna and Arjuna. Arjuna was a warrior. Arjuna was perplexed, like, I have to act in this world, and just living in this world, I'm implicated in so much wrongdoings. And Krishna's like, okay, well, you have to act. And he said, okay, then I'll just give this up because I don't want to be materialist. I'm not going to fight a war just because I want to become a king. It's like, how could I enjoy such material things being a king when I've, at the cost of my own brothers, you know, at the cost of other human beings' lives, how could I do that? He said, yeah, that's true. Krishna said, yeah, that's true. When you fight for your own self, out of ego, then you inherit all the sin, the karma, from killing a human being. He's all, but if you act under for a higher reason, you, in other words, because it's good, then you become a yogi. So how is killing good? That has to be explained. War is not good, but a duty of a kshatriya is to protect people. So in the story, usually people don't understand that. They say, why did Krishna tell Arjuna to kill? Isn't that like going against spiritual philosophy? It's like, no, he wasn't instructed to murder. He was instructed to protect, because that other kingdom, they were just torturing people. They were literally creating a hell for all kinds of people. So in that case, it's not an attack situation. You become a hero. So he's telling Arjuna, be a hero. Be a hero. Stand up for what's right, and don't care if you succeed or you fail. Die knowing that you're in line with truth, that you're in line with goodness. That is Bhagavad Gita. Die doing the right thing. Don't die doing anything just to get something. So that's consciousness of a miser. So to be a yogi in our modern age sounds far out, you know. But yoga means something practical. It means something simple. It means that is we have to connect. Okay, just to finish on this note, I started by saying that generally we have education, career in the forefront, and spirituality, you know, it's there, it's supporting us, it's helping us. And obviously, it's not going to work if you put all spiritual and then all career. So Bhagavad Gita helps make that bridge. And that's what it is why am I eating? Why am I sleeping? Why am I, you know, do I live just to eat and sleep and support this body for without any reason? So no, Bhagavad Gita, this knowledge gives you a higher purpose by which you carry out even the function of eating, even sleeping. And because you're eating for a higher purpose, you're sleeping for a higher purpose, you're breathing for a higher purpose, our real purpose, which is a higher purpose. We're not meant for just like being here for a few short years and just, you know, dying of disease and going, and that's it. That's what it was all about. Nothing is beyond that. No. There's a reason. And Bhagavad Gita explains all of those reasons. We're not just here and we just die and that's it. No, Krishna said the soul is eternal. The soul is going on a journey, life after life after life. And you have to understand that the universe is so great that you have to try to comprehend it and you have to try to understand it. So we need guidance. We need guidance in this world. I mean, who's going to disagree with everyone? It's like, oh, don't be all religious. But we need guidance. People, there's so much madness going on. Things which are unthinkable 100 years ago are going on daily. And that's the thing. And even if we're good and everything in society goes good, then life's temporary. So we should ponder these questions. We should be rational. We should be fair. We should be willing to look at other scriptures. Looking, if we're serious, we should be willing to see what's the philosophies out there. You know, but ultimately, philosophy, it's not just you hold a book and you're in truth. And then you put it in somebody's face and you're like, I have the truth and you don't. And if you don't know it, then sorry for you, man. It's like you have to have the roadmap, but you have to go there. And if you look at Bible, what does the Bible teach? Love God with all your heart. Love thy neighbor. I mean, what's Krishna teach? You know, serve God with all your mind, body, and words. And love all living entities who are part of God. What's the difference? The difference is not that there's a big difference. The goal is the same. But people are not so serious about religion in this country or in the world. Why? We're more interested in materialism. Materialism, it's in our culture. It's in our food. It's in our religion. It's in our politics. Even in religion, there's so much politics. There's so much materialism. So we have to be intelligent enough to discriminate that, okay, even though this is a book of knowledge, somebody may use that for some materialistic purpose. And you have to learn how to be able to see that. You have to learn to see, you know, that's why Krishna tells us about motivation. A person who's truly working for God has no ulterior motive. That person, such a person is loved by all, and that such a person loves all. He said, that's a real yogi. He loves even an ant. He sees the interconnectedness and the sacredness of life. And he doesn't discriminate. Here's an ant, here's a cow, here's a dog. Cow's my food and dog's my friend. No. A learned person? No. It's the interconnectedness of life. And that's something I grew up eating meat, but we have to keep growing. We have to keep progressing. So I'll end there just on that note that wherever we are in our life, we should try to see spiritual life as not so much a label or hand tag, you know, but we should try to really sincerely understand who are these saintly people, who wrote these books, and what is the message they're trying to tell us, and if there's benefit, why should we not accept that? So I'll end there. Thank you very much for your attention. So before we move on, I'd just like to invite any comments or questions. It's appreciated. Yes.
Could you elaborate on what are these six different philosophies that you were talking about?
Well,
repeat the question.
She asked, what are the six different philosophies under the name Hinduism? And basically, in Sanskrit, we have this word, the sadarshanas, or six darshans, which are six philosophies. And they vary greatly. Of course, pretty much you have the Vedic literature, it's the Sanskrit literature, and you have various interpretations. That's not different than having one Bible and having, you know, Catholics and Christians and born again. So you have one scripture, but you have different interpretations. So it's not that, you know, there's different interpretations. Oh, I should just say that all religions are equal. But it's not at the same time. All religions aren't equal, and all religions are... It's not that all religions are right or all religions are wrong. You can't say all... That's just too extreme. It doesn't make sense. All religions are right. That doesn't make sense. All religions are wrong. That doesn't make sense either. So we have to use our intelligence. And, you know, these schools are there. But, of course, there's commonalities that you'll find in all religions. And that's what I'm saying. We should be intelligent enough, have enough respect for life and religion and people to respect all those different philosophies, even if we don't agree with them. And see that there are universal principles, kindness to all, forgiveness. It's not Hindu, it's not Christian. They're universal things. So, I mean, they have different names. Like, one is yoga, one is Vedanta. This is a school, Vedanta, where we receive this knowledge. And within Vedanta, this is Vaishnava understanding. But there's many others. There's, like, Buddhism or logic. Then there's one, atomism, where not everything's just atoms. It's kind of like modern science. So actually, the way I understood it is quite amazing. It's like pretty much any philosophy in the world can be placed into one of these six categories. And that's the beauty of Indian genius. Is they know, okay, any philosophy that you can come up with is going to fit under one of these classification systems. So why do they do that? So people have access to use their intelligence, to study them, to see. It's not that, you know, I'm a Christian, my mom was Christian, therefore I'm a Christian, and I don't ask any questions. No, you should ask questions. You should find out why. Why are you Christian? Does that answer your question? Six darshans. If you look on the internet, if you look on Wikipedia, they'll give you like 1, 2, 3, 4, and they'll tell you briefly what they are.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
So yeah. All right. Anything else? Okay. Yes, John.
I was wondering how Lot seemed to say that. Really, he came to America and he said, well, my purpose really is not to introduce Hinduism or introduce this. And he said that his recommendation was that people be good Christians.
Yeah.
He felt that the
real... Yeah, that's in that chapter that I mentioned.
It seems to me that he felt that the problem isn't that they don't know anything about Hinduism. The problem is...
Yeah.
Not practicing their own religions.
That's what I'm also saying.
And that was
it's a roadmap. If you have the Bible, you still have to learn how to act. So God, love God with all your heart, love thy neighbor. You still have to learn that. How are you going to learn that? Easy to learn that? You just, okay, I love God today and I love everyone. Yeah, but then you'll be tested. Then somebody says something and then you're like, get out of my way, you know? So you get agitated, and then you have to learn that. So there has to be a process, a spiritual practice, which is that you're trying to live up to various spiritual ideals and not caring for the results. So that practice has to be there. It's very important.
So I was wondering, then why does he think it's so important to introduce chanting, the heart, nod, and then...
Because it's a kind of technology.
Does he think that...
So it has its use. So
does he think that that may succeed where Christianity failed or something like that?
No, it's not like that. It's not that Hinduism comes to save Christianity's
thing. Well, his version.
There's, in other words...
I mean the Vajra version.
Okay, so there are different versions, and that's why we have different religions. But reality is not a different version. Reality is the same for everyone. So how we perceive that one reality, then we classify into different religions. But when we're... Okay, so when we take it apart and we say, here's religion, then at the end, we have to put it all together and we have to see it as a whole, which is there's one reality with people having different interpretations. But still, there's one reality. So no, Prabhupada didn't come to introduce... to add anything to any religion, but he just encouraged people to follow, and by following, people naturally come to higher levels of awareness, and they can live in harmony, they can live coexistence nicely. So, okay, I think we'll just end there. And thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome. So, I request you again to please rise and do a kind job of answering the question that is much helpful.